welcome to the House of Commons. This is a regular podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I'm a political blogger and commentator. And every week we get a guest on from the world of politics and or journalism to discuss the two or three biggest political topics of the week. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Isabel Hardman, who is assistant editor of The Spectator. Hi, Isabel.
Hello.
Hi, great to have you back again. Okay, so wanted to talk about the obviously last few days in politics. The first thing I thought we could talk about is the challenges debate from Thursday. I believe you were in the spin room, is that right?
I was afterwards. Yeah.
So what was the perspective like from there? Then I just watched it on my television at home.
Well, I think we all started watching the debate expecting it to be a real beating up for Ed Miliband, and it was, because Natalie Bennett, Nicola Sturgeon and Leanne Wood had planned what they were going to do beforehand, and they ganged up on him throughout the programme. But what was interesting was not so much what they were saying, which was, you're not left-wing enough, we won't support you unless you're left-wing enough, here are the ways in which you're not left-wing enough. It was actually the way Ed Miliband reacted, which was very cool, very calm, collected, quite reasonable. And he still managed to appear to be a leader of the opposition, as well as someone defending his own views and policies. And that was really impressive, because this was a really tough debate for him. He came out with some good lines. He was good when he took on Nigel Farage over Nigel Farage's comments about HIV. So we got to the end of the debate really surprised. We were expecting Ed Miliband to try to survive, but actually I felt that he came out in a really strong position. And The Tories who are in the spin room, even though David Cameron had declined to take part, the Tories who were in the spin room were clearly trying to talk up Nicola Sturgeon. But you could just see that actually they were thinking, wow, we can't really attack Ed Miliband anymore. So we're going to have to go for his potential to make a deal with the SNP, because that's more powerful than him as a sort of weak leader.
Yeah, I actually wondered why the Tories were even allowed into the spin room, given that Cameron refused to turn up to the debate. I thought they should have been punished by not allowing any Tories in there at all. Or is that a bit too harsh on my part?
No, I have to say, I think, I've all the way along thought that Cameron should have taken part in the debates, because I think it's a good way of encouraging, you know, people to take an interest in politics when there's a big choice coming up. I thought it was miserable that he didn't sign up. So I also thought that it was a bit miserable that the spinners were then allowed into the spin room. What difference having people in the spin room makes is another matter, but certainly I thought perhaps a little bit of a punishment wouldn't have been the worst thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could probably do an entire podcast on, you know, whether there is any point to those. No offense, Isabel. I know you were there, and I know a lot of your colleagues were there. But yeah, I mean, people watch the debate, don't they? Do they really watch those programmes about what the pundits think about what the debate was about afterwards? I'm not so sure.
I doubt it. Yeah. I think the only thing I would say about that spin room is, I mean, the best piece on it was Marina Hyde's piece in The Guardian about how ridiculous it was. The only thing that is useful about it is you get to see what the party's lines of attack over the next few days are going to be. So you had Liz Truss talking about the potential for a deal between Labour and the SNP. So in terms of sort of having things flagged up to you, it's very helpful. In terms of getting any sort of wisdom at all from these politicians who are wandering around telling you that they thought their leader was great, it's not helpful at all.
Yeah. And just coming back to the actual substance of the debate itself, did you think that having three out of the five panellists women, do you think that made any difference? Because I was struggling to think of a kind of, you know, high profile political debate like that where the majority of the people on the panel were female. Do you think it did make a difference to the dynamic?
I think it was sort of a historic moment having so many women in a big political debate about the election. I thought that was great. I do have to say, I think some of the comments we've seen over the past few days about the effect have been slightly overblown, because these three women cooperated with one another, not because they're women, but because they're left wing and in two cases they're nationalist. And that, I think, is much more powerful than gender in binding people together. If you've seen Liz Truss and Caroline Flint go head to head after some of these debates, they have shown plenty of the aggression and competitive spirit and perhaps a certain unpleasantness that women are just as capable of as men. And I found some of the comments slightly patronising, to suggest that just because you include more women, suddenly everything becomes lovely. Because I went to an all-girls school, and I can assure you that that is not what happens when there's a lot of women in one room.
Yeah, my wife assures me that that is also true. Yeah. I've never obviously been, you know, in a room where only women are. That's not possible by definition. Obviously they had the group hug at the end, which seemed to get quite a lot of coverage. And I just, you know, you couldn't have imagined, say, Gordon Brown, David Cameron and Nick Clegg having a group hug at the end of the 2010 debates. I mean, because obviously they were sort of at each other's throats. I think an interesting aspect of the dynamic between the three women on the panel is that they're not really fighting each other. In fact, I don't think there is any seat in the country where they're against each other at all.
Well, I think that the Greens, I know the Scottish Green Party are separate to Natalie Bennett's Green Party, but I suppose they are contesting seats in Scotland, but they decided clearly that the overall benefit would be to work together because they're still pursuing a left-wing agenda and the Greens don't expect to win any seats. So that's probably a bit of a decisive factor too in their cooperation.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you thought Ed Miliband had a very good night, but I did wonder if just towards the end, when Sturgeon was, it was actually quite patronising the way that she did it, in that, you know, she was basically almost saying, I'm trying to save you from yourself, Ed. And, you know, you need to come with us and join us, be one of us. And she seemed to be being quite nice to him and saying that, you know, she will back him. But she must have known that the effect of that was going to be that the Tories would use that to attack Ed Miliband. In fact, it may even be the strongest remaining line of attack now. They certainly seem to be banging on about it. She must have known that was going to happen. So despite the fact that he seemed to perform quite well, hasn't he been left with a problem now, in that from now until polling day, he is just going to be asked this question over and over again? What are you going to do about the SNP? What influence are the SNP going to have, etc.?
Yeah, and also the Tories have been really surprised by how effective their SNP attack lines have actually been. There are a lot of senior Tories who were really sceptical about all these Salmond and then Sturgeon posters popping up in constituencies and using it as a way of frightening voters. But then they used that line and they saw how much it hit home for voters. And I've just been talking to some people at polling companies who say that now voters are bringing it up unprompted in focus groups, the risk of a Labour SNP deal. Now, I know he's ruled out a coalition, but as the Tories have pointed out, he hasn't ruled out a deal, which is what was on the cards anyway. So, you know, they're not going to stop talking about it just because he ruled out something that wasn't going to happen anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of brings me to the next subject I wanted to talk about. I mean, it, one quite neatly segues into the other, really, which is what influence the SNP are likely to have in the next parliament. I mean, from my perspective, I've said this before, I think the way the Tories have gone for the SNP and attacked them and basically tried to imply that it would somehow be wrong for SNP MPs to have any influence in the government of the country, I think is very dangerous on a number of levels. Firstly, you know, it's only a few months ago since the Scottish electorate voted pretty marginally to reject going independent. They only need another 5% of people. It was 45%. So if they can get 50, if they can just get another, you know, tenth of the people who already voted that way in another referendum, say, in another few years' time, the union will split up. And the Conservatives, who were supposed to be the strongest unionist party, it used to be in their title, I don't know if it still is, they seem to be doing everything that they can to push the Scottish people into voting for independence. If they're basically being told, your democratic choice of who you send to Westminster, we're just going to say is illegitimate and cannot be in government. And maybe a kind of, you know, associated point is, what can Ed Miliband do about this? Because if the SNP have, say, 50 MPs, they'll almost certainly be in a position where they could vote any government down. So no matter what Ed says, it almost feels like he's being boxed into a corner, in that no matter how much he protests that he won't require their votes, he will, won't he?
Well, it's not just that. I think it's also that the Tories are talking up the Scottish National Party because it suits them up to the 7th of May. Now, from the 8th of May onwards, if the SNP have done very well, which all the polls are suggesting they will, and ended up with a majority in Scotland and the Tories are the ones who managed to get back into government by hook or by crook, there will be a massive legitimacy crisis in the United Kingdom, whereby David Cameron and George Osborne will announce, I don't know, some more benefit cuts, because they've got quite a few more of those planned over the next couple of years. And Nicola Sturgeon will turn around and say, we didn't vote for this in Scotland. Scotland didn't vote for this sort of government. And therefore, that will stoke nationalist sentiment even more. And as you say, they don't need to push it up by that much. That they only need to convince a few more people who voted no last time, who then voted for the SNP in the general election, that a referendum is needed. Now, this morning on Marsh, you talked about the circumstances changing. Well, I think actually part of those circumstances changing in her eyes is a legitimacy crisis in the United Kingdom. And I think the Tories are being very short-termist in talking up Nicola Sturgeon. I'm not saying that Tories praising Nicola Sturgeon is necessarily going to hold that much sway in Scotland, but the effect that it has in the media, where we're all writing furiously about her because she's so impressive, certainly adds to her momentum.
Yeah. So what do you think about the position of Ed Miliband? I mean, if the Tories end up back in government again, then the kind of scenario you've talked about will probably play out. But if Labour end up with, let's say hypothetically they get, I don't know, 290, 300 seats, and the SNP have got the 30 or 40 that the polls at an absolute minimum suggest they're going to get. I mean, do you think that Labour would go for a minority government, but with kind of tacit support from the SNP? Because it strikes me they would struggle to really go any other way, certainly with Clegg being the leader of the Lib Dems, the way they've gone at each other's throats for the last 5 years.
Yeah, the Lib Dem Labour coalition question is interesting. I sort of think they'd probably make it work. So I think to get the numbers up, Labour would still rather turn to some kind of formal deal with the Lib Dems. And I'm not sure that Clegg will be the massive barrier that some people in Labour say he is. I mean, I talk to a lot of Labour front benchers who say he's a problem, but I think things can be a problem before an election, which suddenly don't seem so much of a problem when you're knackered after an election. And, you know, if you're Labour, you don't have as much money as the Tories to fight a second election. You don't have as much of a luxury to sort of think, well, we could have another go. The question is, as you say, is actually if the Lib Dems don't get that many seats, which it looks like they won't, you know, they won't have, probably won't have Danny Alexander. There's quite a few others who they're going to lose. Then you'll need the support of the SNP anyway. And this is the big problem. I was having some very interesting conversations with Labour figures about this this weekend, actually, about what it would be like keeping the SNP on side. And they're very bullish about it. They were saying, well, look, you know, if we come out with a left-wing Queen's speech and say to them, fine, bring it on, you know, you can vote against this Queen's speech and bring the Labour government down, then you'll bring the Tories in. Just see how Scotland will like that. I think that's fine again for them to say that now, but after the election, they will be under huge pressure, as the Tories rightly say, to make sure that Queen's speech is pretty darn lefty, because they don't want to risk it in turning around, calling Sturgeon's bluff and finding her saying, actually, no, we're not going to support it, go away.
Yeah, because I think that if Labour did take that very kind of, you know, hard-nosed, you know, pushing it to the wire approach, I think they might be in for a nasty surprise, because the reason is that there's quite a specific reason. It strikes me that I don't wish to sound patronising to the Scottish electorate here, but they don't seem to be voting in a way that's necessarily in line with rational expectations, is probably the best euphemistic way I could put it. I mean, you know, the oil price has fallen through the floor, and yet support for independence, if anything, seems to have gone up. So it almost seems like independence has become an emotional thing rather than a rational thing.
Totally agree with that.
And so therefore, if there was a Labour government, and if the Labour government fell because the SNP decided to vote them down, I just wonder if the SNP would get as much blame as Labour think for that in Scotland. I think the SNP could just say, well, you know, this wasn't a legitimate government and, you know, we did our best. They'll have some argument. They'll say it was Trident, or there'll be some way that they can cover this and say, look, they wouldn't give us what we wanted, you know, and actually really what we need to be is an independent country. In order to get the government that we want, and all of this messing around is just doing no good, and actually let's have another referendum. And if they win, Holyrood in 2016, I suspect that's exactly what they will do. So although on the surface it would seem that Labour are in a very strong position, I wonder if they might be in a very, very weak position.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And actually, let's not forget that if a lot of a lot of Scottish seats have gone from Labour to SNP, then it's a little bit more difficult for Labour to argue that their voice will be the one that's heard first in Scotland when they start talking about the SNP pulling out of the government. Actually, and as you say, when we talk about these sort of voting decisions being emotional, that almost sounds like we're sort of judging Scots for not being rational in some way. But I really judge Labour on that, because they have created a situation through a number of methods whereby actually voting SNP is the emotional choice. It's an emotional rebellion against the Labour Party. It's not just that they haven't knocked on the doors in their seats for years and years and years and have just assumed arrogantly that people are going to support them. And, you know, by the way, the Tories have done that in lots of areas too. But actually, it's also that they too have stoked this sort of nationalist sentiment. You know, Jim Murphy and his colleagues, so they held a press conference recently where I think he used the word tourist or day trippers, I think it was. He said, let's take a question from some day trippers, referring to press who'd come up from London. Now, if you're using that kind of language, what do you expect to happen? You're actually just stoking those sort of nationalist fires, and they're being punished for that.
Yeah. And also, you know, when you think about some of the leading lights that Labour have put forward in recent times, I mean, the former leader before Jim Murphy wasn't very good and actually stood down and kind of tossed in a few grenades as she left. And also Alistair Darling being put up as the figurehead of the staying in the union campaign. You know, you couldn't really get a much more kind of, you know, technocratic, non-emotional type leader. When you compare that with someone like Salmond or, you know, Nicola Sturgeon. Nicola Sturgeon does seem to be a bit more hard-headed, but she can also appeal to the heart, and she can fill stadiums. You know, there aren't many politicians that can do that.
Yeah, she's got box office appeal. And actually, I was thinking this morning, so I was on the Andrew Marr show with her, and she's just such a class act in a way that she took over from Alex Salmond, who's a big beast, and there hasn't been a single whisper about her being a lesser figure than him. And that could have so easily been the case with so many other people who'd taken over. Actually, Nicola Sturgeon has been better for the SNP than Alex Salmond, and that is a huge compliment to her.
Yeah, and I'm not sure anyone would have predicted that. In fact, there's quite a lot about Scottish politics and the SNP that I don't think most people would have predicted that's happened over the last year. I mean, the fact that the referendum was lost from the SNP's perspective somewhat narrowly, I mean, maybe that could have been predicted. But then what's happened since, with a massive surge for the SNP, that's gone in the diametric opposite direction to the received opinion, which was that, you know, once the referendum was lost, the SNP would collapse in a load of internal recriminations. It's been the exact opposite, and it's been quite fascinating to watch. And, you know, as a pundit, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen next. And, you know, I get invited onto radio programmes and television programmes to say what I think is going to happen, and I haven't got a clue.
No, me neither. It's great. I mean, it's a great time to be covering politics, isn't it? But it's not a great time to be talking with any sort of authority about politics, because anyone who does ends up looking like a bit of a chump.
Absolutely. The last thing I wanted to talk about, which again is sort of related to what we've just been saying, but a bit more specifically, is the question, what if nobody can govern? Because it is possible after the next election that there is just no stable government that can be formed. You know, if the SNP are playing, you know, games, as they might well, I mean, you mentioned about Alex Salmond, but actually he'll probably be back in Westminster and he'll probably be leading his troops at that point. So, you know, who knows what he'll get up to. You know, depending on where the Lib Dems are, depending on exactly how legitimate or illegitimate either of the two main parties' claims to be in government are. I mean, you could have a situation where, you know, Labour get the most votes. Sorry, the Tories get the most votes, but don't get the most seats. So Labour's probably in a better position to form a more stable government, but there's a big question of legitimacy because they got fewer votes than the Tories. And there's all kinds of other permutations, which, you know, I won't go through them all. There's too many to list anyway, but it is quite feasible that there really isn't any stable government. But because of the Fixed Parliament Act, what we're unlikely to have is, you know, government can't be formed, the government collapses and we just go to the country, because there's a 14-day period when another government can try and form. So we could conceivably have a couple of stabs at this, or even more, before we go back to the electorate. And I mean, one thing in the back of my mind, which I just feel can't happen in this country for all kinds of reasons, but maybe we could just briefly explore it, the possibility of some kind of grand coalition. Because the only reason why the SNP would be able to, you know, hold Ed Miliband to ransom in some way, is because they'd hold the balance of power. But there's probably quite a lot of what Labour would want to get through that the Tories actually want to get through as well. And there's probably quite a lot that the Tories and Labour are closer to each other on than they are with the SNP. But I just can't see it happening in this country.
Yeah, no, I don't think we're quite at the stage where the parties can imagine a grand coalition. We're not at war. And I think even imagining the SNP and Labour working together is still quite hard because of the tribal dislike. But it's a whole different ballgame between Labour and the Tories. And who knows? We were surprised by the hung parliament in 2010, so we might be surprised. It's not as ludicrous a suggestion as it was a couple of years ago. I mean, I've taken pieces on Coffee House about grand coalitions because I realise that, you know, people who suggest them are now not conspiracy theorists. So yeah, as you said earlier, it's not a good idea to sound too confident about anything at the moment.
I mean, I guess I wonder if one of the contributing factors to why a grand coalition is just seen as impossible in our country, when actually there are other countries where this does happen fairly regularly, certainly on the continent, and I'm going to bang on about one of my hobby horses, but I can't help it because I think everything for me is filtered through this prism, and that is the electoral system. Because the way that the two parties would be punished by the electorate if they did go into coalition with each other would be massively disproportionate to the offence committed. And what I mean by that is, if, let's say, they both get 34% of the election, they could easily find that they only get, say, you know, 27, 26% at a subsequent election because some of their core abandoned them. But that could mean not the difference between getting, you know, 270 seats and 230 seats. It could be the difference between getting 270 seats and getting 100 seats or fewer, just because of the way our electoral system works. And especially someone like Farage would then come up on the inside track, and he could sweep and literally pick up dozens or even well over 100 seats on the back of it. So the risk is so much higher than in more proportional systems, where actually what you'd end up with is a few percent here, a few percent there, but maybe after a subsequent election it wouldn't make a huge amount of difference.
Yeah, and I do think that there will be more appetite for electoral reform after this election.
Yay!
Given, I've got quite a lot of sympathy for it too, because I think it makes people work harder, and I don't like lazy politicians very much. But I think there'll be a lot of people who will have voted for one of the minor parties who will see the percentage of the vote that those parties got, and then look at the number of seats they've got in the House of Commons and think, what happened there?
Well, you could have a bizarre position where the SNP get 4% of the vote and 50 seats, and UKIP get 13% of the vote and 2 seats. Surely that's just going to look, no matter how that is attempted to be spun by supporters of the current system, it's unjustifiable, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it'll be very interesting. But again, are we in second referendum territory with with electoral reform? I suspect the appetite for another referendum on that is probably not quite as strong as one for Scottish independence, even though the latter is a bit of a bigger question. But I think one of the questions to sort of mull over the next couple of weeks is how UKIP are actually going to do, because they do seem to be declining at the moment. And I just wonder whether some of their predictions about how many seats they would get will end up looking a little bit foolish when we get to polling day.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Rochester and Strood for Mark Reckless's by-election there. And, I mean, I do remember as the result came in, obviously it wasn't as resounding as the Clacton by-election result, but it was still a decent win. And I remember, I mean, a lot of the pundits around the table at the time, we're back to pundits predicting stuff again. but they all seemed to think that now on the back of that, UKIP would get at least between 5 and 10 seats of the election, and it could even be quite significantly higher. And I do remember cautioning against getting too carried away at the time, because, you know, a defecting MP that already has a solid vote in the constituency and etc. And looking back, I'm just starting to wonder if that might turn out to have been UKIP's high watermark winning those by-elections. Maybe that combined with the Euro election results as well, which is obviously very good for them as well. But I just wonder if the brutal reality of first past the post is just exerting its influence again here now, and they're just going to keep slip sliding until election day.
I think there is that. I think also there's a sort of resource allocation problem here, which is that they've been trying to ape the Lib Dems in terms of building up support seat by seat in order to beat the first past the post problem. But they haven't been doing that intelligently in some cases. And Farage has just, you know, made a rod for his own back by saying, I'll stand down if I don't win in South Thanet. That's a bad thing to have said, given that he picked South Thanet not because it was winnable, but because he had a local connection.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't win there, then UKIP will be in a real pickle, because their second tier of people are good, but they're not like Farage. They're not as magnetic as Farage. It's not a case of Alex Salmond handing over to Nicola Sturgeon here, that there's a gap between Nigel Farage and his deputies.
Yeah. And I heard you on the Spectator podcast as well, talking about how you think that Farage has made a big mistake in, you know, allocating his time, his precious time, in trying to help other UKIP candidates win seats in other areas, when really he should be throwing everything into South Thanet, because if he doesn't win that, it's all over for him personally, but actually it could be all over for his party as well if he doesn't end up in Parliament.
And you have to have a lot of sympathy for the guy, because he's holding the whole thing together. I mean, there are quite a lot of splits within UKIP, and Farage is, you know, people mock him, but he works jolly hard. You can't fault his work ethic in terms of campaigning for UKIP. And he is trying to front a national campaign, because he knows that the cameras follow him around. They don't, with the greatest of respect, follow Stephen Wolfe and Suzanne Evan around in quite the same way. And so he's trying to do that. And he's also trying to fight a really intense local campaign. Now, lots of people would fold under that pressure. So you've got to give it to Farage for doing so well, actually, up to this point.
Okay, well, maybe we'll end things on that that point of praise for Nigel. That doesn't often happen on this podcast, I have to say.
Praise for Farage.
Praise for Farage. So there we go. Thanks very much for your time today, Isabel. Much appreciated.
Oh, thank you. Really enjoyed that.
And I'd just like to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly host the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.